Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated January 18th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's article, top of the fold. Bear, tight-lipped, but big plans hinted by Amanda Jones Hoyle. This article is from the Research Triangle Park. Big plans are being made for an expansion of Bayer Crop Science's research and development capacity near its North American headquarters in Research Triangle Park. But company executives are not showing all their cards just yet. Bayer Crop Science executives aren't saying if or when the company might file new building plans for the nearly 70 acres of land the agricultural biotech company purchased in December. Bayer Crop Science paid $6.2 million for the property directly north of its RTP campus, a deal that ranked as one of the highest land prices paid in the region in 2012. In the meantime, Bayer Crop Science has signed a lease to take occupancy of an entire 82,000-square-foot laboratory building in Durham, which Wyeth Pharmaceuticals vacated 2 years ago. Wyeth at one time had 70 researchers working on vaccine developments in the Keystone Technology Park building at 407 Davis Drive. The research facility, however, was closed in late 2010, one of the many casualties following Pfizer's acquisition of the pharmaceutical firm in 2009. Bayer Crop Science spokeswoman Courtney Beck confirms that the company has signed the lease for the building in Durham, but she says she can't comment further due to a confidentiality clause within the lease. Bayer Crop Science has made it no secret, however, that it plans to greatly expand its R&D operations worldwide at a cost of about $6.5 billion between 2011 and 2016. Former Bayer Crop Science CEO Sandra Peterson stated in a media briefing in Germany in September that she expected the seeds business, which is in the process of relocating its global headquarters from Lyon, France, to RTP, to continue its rapid growth pace. She forecasts that the seeds business would double the contribution it makes to the company's overall sales from the current level, around 20%, by 2016. In 2011, about $960 million, or roughly 25%, of Bayer's group's research and development budget was spent at Bayer Crop Science. Peterson resigned from the company in November and has been succeeded by Liam Condon as CEO. In the Triangle, Bayer Crop Science currently employs about 640 people at its North American headquarters in RTP, its Innovation Center building in Morrisville, and other research and sales facilities in Cary and in Clayton. It recently completed construction of a $20 million 60,000-square-foot greenhouse, and it will be breaking ground on 6,600-square-foot North American Bee Care Center in RTP in February. Bayer Crop Science ranks among the six largest agriculture biotechnology companies in the world, five of which have a major presence in central North Carolina, including Syngenta, BASF Plant Science, Monsanto, and DuPont Pioneer. Paul Erlanch, the Biotechnology Crops Development Director at the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, says he has not heard details about Bayer Crop Science's most recent R&D expansion plans in the region. "But it doesn't surprise me," he says. "All of the crop science companies are evaluating expansion opportunities," Erlanch says. "Probably the largest agrobiotech cluster globally is here." Syngenta spokesman Steve Goldsmith says his company recently completed construction of a $71 million greenhouse and research building at its RTP campus, and its researchers expect to begin testing the systems and begin planting this quarter. "Our approach in the design of this greenhouse, which is a one-of-a-kind research facility, will allow us to test very specific elements of environmental pressures to help us deliver better crops to farmers in the future," Goldsmith says. Syngenta also submitted new building plans to Durham County planners in mid-September for a project that would include a 200,000-square-foot building on Syngenta's RTP campus. The building would be used for administrative office space and research laboratories. Goldsmith says, however, that no decision has been made on whether new construction in RTP will be funded beyond the current work on the greenhouse. Next up, this week's lead article, the $279 million battle, implications immense in Rex Wake Med showdown, by Jason DeBrun. This article is from Raleigh. When an appellate court ruled in Rex Healthcare's favor on January 15th, saying it could move forward with a cardiovascular care center, executives at the hospital no doubt smiled. But they also no doubt had one eye on a potential future ruling. What happens next with Rex's Heart Center, part of a wider project costing an estimated $279 million, will impact the heart and vascular health care landscape in Wake County for years, indeed decades to come. Rex's crosstown rival, Wake Med Health and Hospitals, has tried to throw sand in Rex's gears at nearly every turn. At stake is a business of hundreds, maybe thousands of patients who require heart and cardiovascular services. By some measures, this is a classic high-stakes case of competing for business. According to Rex's own projections, the proposed project would positively impact its bottom line. In 2010, the hospital reported $35 million of net income, a 6% profit margin. By 2018, assuming project approval, Rex estimates net income of $83 million, good enough for a 9% profit margin. We don't think that what they've proposed is needed, says Stan Taylor, Wake Med's vice president for corporate planning. Naturally, there is a different tone in Rex's office. There is no doubt that more high-quality cardiovascular services are needed to meet the growing demand from patients in this community and beyond, says Eric Hawkins, UNC Healthcare Vice President of Heart and Vascular Services. The state's approval of our proposed projects helps prove that point. Rex is a wholly owned subsidiary of UNC Healthcare in Chapel Hill. While Rex officials are quick to point out that Wake Med is not the only hospital in the market that performs heart and vascular procedures, it certainly has a large market share. Of the 13,034 diagnostic and intervention cardiac catheterization procedures performed in Wake County in fiscal year 2009, which ended June 30 that year, Wake Med performed 9,550 at its campuses in Raleigh and Cary. That makes up nearly three-quarters of all these common heart procedures performed in Wake County. That year, Rex performed 2,792 procedures and Duke Raleigh 692. Rex wouldn't be the only hospital in this area to move into an area where a competitor considered itself a market leader. Wake Med itself has built emergency facilities in the Briar Creek area and begun construction on a major hospital in North Raleigh that will focus extensively on women's care, particularly pregnant women or young mothers, a service area Rex has long counted as one of its jewels. The saga of Rex's Heart Center can be traced to June 2010 when the hospital applied to expand and renovate its surgical and cardiovascular services and create a new main entrance and public concourse. The initial cost estimate came to $132 million. As with any major healthcare initiative in North Carolina, Rex needed approval from the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, which regulates healthcare services in this state. Rex received approval for his application on October 29, 2010. On April 2011, Rex broadened the scope of the project. It applied to add 11 acute care beds and move 115 of its existing beds into the proposed heart and vascular tower. The request for the 11 new beds was denied, but the hospital received approval for everything else in late September. The investment listed on the application was an estimated $279 million. But it was more than regulators that Rex had to satisfy. Under North Carolina law, competitors may step in and challenge projects approved by regulators. That's what Wake Med did in both cases. The appellate court denied Wake Med's appeal on the first application of January 15th, but will likely not rule on the second appeal until later this year or possibly next year. Because the three appellate judges ruled in unison, Wake Med does not have an automatic right to appeal to the North Carolina Supreme Court, though it may petition the court if it chooses, explains Elizabeth Frock, an associate attorney with Nelson Mullins LLP, a firm that deals heavily in health care law. Frock was not involved in this particular case and says the odds of the Supreme Court hearing an appeal after a unanimous appellate ruling are low. Having the ability to perform heart and vascular services is a potentially enormous market. Genetics certainly play a role in heart disease, but lifestyle choices play a role as well. With many Americans not leading healthy lifestyles, this is a market that could see a boom in patients. The American Heart Association reports that 21% of adults meet federal guidelines for physical activity and fewer than 1% of adults meet the definition of an ideal healthy diet. Some 155 million adults are overweight or obese, and 24 million children fall in that category. An estimated 28 million adults have diabetes, and as many as 87 million have prediabetes. Dr. Ravish Shar, an interventional cardiologist with Wake Heart and Vascular, is affiliated with Rex, says the medical community has made enormous strides over the past two decades in treating heart disease, but because of the unhealthy lifestyles, the risk factor has not appreciably improved, if at all. With that in mind, WakeMed wants to widen its healthy heart strategy by forging partnerships in communities to stop heart disease before it happens, says Betsy Gaskin-McLean, WakeMed Heart and Vascular Vice President. She says, "The work we do with individuals outside our walls is critical." Still on the front page and in a related article, this one is entitled, "Is There a Need?" Well, that's the question, but an answer is hard to find. This article is also by Jason DeBruin and was written from Raleigh. In North Carolina, the state's Department of Health and Human Services regulates health care facilities, in part to prevent duplication of services. Hospitals often invest millions of dollars in new machinery, but because reimbursement levels are set firm, it can sometimes take time to recoup the investments. From the state's perspective, it wants only that patients have an avenue to receive quality health care. If one hospital is providing that care, it would be redundant for another hospital to offer the same service. Eric Hawkins with Rex Healthcare and UNC Healthcare says the impetus for Rex's investment in an expanded heart center is not to directly expand services, but to consolidate them to find efficiencies. Naturally, this could mean an increased opportunity for patients. The only question that's left to be answered is this: would these additional patients find adequate treatment at Wake Med or Duke Raleigh? That's a tough question to answer, says Mark Hewitt, a health law attorney with Williams Mulland in Raleigh. How can a hospital definitely prove that any patient would have not received care at any other facility, he poses. I don't think anyone would ever be able to prove that, he says, answering his own hypothetical question. In highly competitive markets, like the Triangle, the process through which hospitals apply to add services has somewhat of a blind spot. Each year, the state releases a document called the State Medical Facilities Plan that outlines various types of healthcare services, such as operating rooms, rehabilitation services, or nursing care facilities, to name just three. There are a host of other services, however, of which most heart and vascular care is one. In these cases, the state does not predetermine a specific need, so hospitals must prove that need in an application. In proving this need, however, hospitals don't necessarily have to prove that a certain percentage of residents are going without services, simply that there is a need in the general area. In the case of Rex's application, WakeMed argues it can handle heart and vascular services just fine, while Rex argues there is enough of a need for them as well. So far, both Department of Health and Human Services and the North Carolina Court of Appeals agree with Rex. If regular economics apply to health care, WakeMed would need it to increase its pricing for heart and vascular services if it lost patients. However, in situations like this, it doesn't necessarily mean prices will increase for patients, says Hewitt. with the third-party payer system in America, nearly all pricing is pre-negotiated or, in the case of Medicare, simply mandated, so there is little elasticity in pricing. There's a lot more of a disconnect than in a regular supply and demand, he says. Generally speaking, there is the possibility that duplication of services could increase prices, but effectively, in healthcare, it won't necessarily drive up the cost. Now inside the front page, Triton after $35 million total for its stents, by Lauren K. Onisorge from Durham. Triton Medical's $22 million haul in new financing won't cover just an unmet need. It will push venture-backed Triton ahead in an area where current medical solutions are jury-rigged by cardiothoracic surgeons. Stents that follow veins or arteries when they branch off. But while CEO Sean McCarthy says the money should take the company through the federal review process, a securities filing reveals the company is looking for an additional $13 million. Added up, $35 million is a lot of cash, but it's a small amount compared to the potential returns, says McCarthy. We're creating evidence, randomized data, in an area where it hasn't been done before, he says, saying the data is the reason for the investor confidence. Stents, which are tubes placed into arteries or blood vessels to hold them open, have been around since the 1960s. Angioplasty has become a relatively common procedure, but there's something lacking in what's known as bifurcation disease. That's when a narrowing in the coronary artery near a side branch where arteries divide into different pathways. Dr. Etisham Shami Mahmood, director of the Interventional Cardiology and Cardiac Cath Lab and chief of cardiovascular medicine at the University of California at San Diego, explains, basically the current situation, not uncommonly when we are stenting, there is usually a branch called the side branch that can be very large to medium to small side vessels. He says the large ones have to be addressed because they can cut off oxygen. There are a number of procedures, but they are all basically workarounds. All of these techniques prolong the procedure and are somewhat cumbersome, have a high reblockage risk, and put the patient at risk of forming a blood clot, says Mahmood. He says he's aware of various companies that have worked on side branch stents that can accommodate other stents, adding that success would be welcome. Absolutely. That's one of the big things we've been waiting for well over a decade. Overlooked, that is, until 2003, when Dr. Aaron Kaplan, professor of medicine at Dartmouth Medical School, founded Triton, along with venture capitalist Dan Cole. The idea was very simple, to develop a stent that could treat a side branch and could marry the workhorse drug eluting stent. The three-part stent starts in the side branch and ends in the main vessel. A traditional stent can be inserted through the Triton branch. If you look at it, it looks like a standard stent, McCarty says, only it's three parts to conform to the shape of the side branch and to secure itself to the vessel. There's an opening that will allow the main vessel to travel through it, reducing complications. The process, he adds, fits with the current construct of reimbursement, meaning patients shouldn't expect to pay more for the procedure, and that's what's currently being done on surgical tables. Triton has gained approval for its stents in the Middle East and Europe, hoping to submit an application to the Food and Drug Administration by the end of the year and is hoping for a 2014 U.S. approval. The company is currently enrolling patients in the U.S. study, a major milestone that investors can physically see, McCarthy says. Already more than 6,500 patients worldwide have had Triton stent implants. We've reduced investor risk, he says. We know what the pathways look like to get in the U.S. market. Noting that Triton is a private company, McCarthy declines to reveal revenue figures. Going forward, Triton could have exclusivity in treating the 20 to 30% branch of lesion patients who have side branch involvement. We have not heard of any other device company even getting an approval to conduct this study, he says, adding that the Triton platform may also be applied to left main coronary artery disease, meaning potentially 200,000 procedures a year, a third of which would be in the United States. Triton has 22 employees, 8 in North Carolina, and others operating remotely. While McCarthy won't be specific, he does say he'll likely add staff. He won't stop in the U.S. either. He plans on using some of the money being raised to accelerate the company's access in Asian markets. Triton investors include PTV Sciences, Rivervest Venture Partners, Spray Venture Partners, and the 3x5 Special Opportunity Fund. The company's overall venture haul is about $45 million so far. Next up, law firms get partner heavy as hiring slows, by Chris Bagley. This article is from Raleigh. A series of promotions on January 1st made Triangle Law Firms more partner-heavy than at any point in years, reflecting more experience to offer clients, but also creating ongoing struggles to regain pre-recession levels of profit. Most firms say business has begun to recover, surprisingly strong in a few cases, leading to most to step up their hiring of associates. For most, however, the hiring hasn't quite kept pace with the number of associates who have become partners. A promotion that usually comes after an associate's sixth, seventh, or eighth year. The Triangle's 20 largest law firms have a total of about 550 partners and about 340 non-partner attorneys, according to regular surveys by the Triangle Business Journal. The resulting ratio of non-partners to partners, known as leverage, is about 0.62, down from about 0.7 in late 2011 and about 0.86 in 2008. Leverage is one of several factors that play into compensation and profitability. Partners can boost their own pay by hiring more associates as long as they have enough work to stay busy. Still, individual law firms don't necessarily target and specific leverage ratio, and managers say it inevitably rises and falls from year to year. It wouldn't be right to delay promotion simply because fewer associates are being hired, says Johnny Loper, managing partner of Womble Carlyle's Raleigh office, which made three new partners on January 1st. Still, consultant Tom Kane says the legal services industry's changing dynamics underscore the importance of scrutinizing an associate's ability to generate new business when deciding whether to make him or her a partner. Kane says not all firms put enough emphasis on that, a concern that he says is highlighted by firms' gradual shift towards partner-heavy structures. A lawyer should not be made a partner unless he contributes to the development of the business, says Kane, who lives in High Point and advises firms in the Triangle and nationwide. The training, the hiring, and all things have to be done in a law firm. Business considerations notwithstanding, managers say the promotions reflect experience that firms can offer clients. Clients want to work with lawyers who know what they're doing, Smith Anderson managing partner Carl Patterson says. Smith Anderson is already Raleigh's largest firm, and it has continued to grow in terms of both partners and associates. After three promotions on January 1st, its website lists 94 partners and 37 other attorneys. Some managing partners say their firms are simply having to assign relatively simple legal work to experienced attorneys on some occasions and bill at rates previously reserved for junior attorneys. Senior partners frequently bill at $400 an hour, while new associates often bill at $200 or less. And now, the silent holding. Cousin of bank's reigning leaders cashes out and steps away from boards in North and South Carolina. This article is by Lee Weisbecker, and it's from Raleigh. Days after she sold off her considerable holdings in Raleigh-based First Citizens Bank shares and resigned from the board, Carmen Holding Ames did the same in Columbia, South Carolina-based First Citizens Bank Corp. The privately held bank, in a special shareholder notice, reveals that a former board member sold back to the bank 160,834 shares of common stock at $490 a share and 683 preferred shares at $33.33 apiece for a total cash outlay of $78.8 million. First Citizens of South Carolina spokeswoman Angela English confirmed that the former board member is in fact Ames, adding, "She served on our board of directors for 21 years and was a valued and diligent member of our board." Combined with roughly $227 million, Ames recognized by selling her First Citizens of Raleigh shares, the South Carolina transaction brings her total exit return to nearly $306 million. In the North Carolina transaction, Ames sold 593,954 Class B shares back to First Citizens for $92 million. Those shares were subsequently canceled, says First Citizens of Raleigh spokeswoman Barbara Thompson. They are still authorized, but they are not outstanding, she says. The other $135 million worth of Class A bank shares were sold to a select group of unnamed accredited investors, according to the SEC filings. Ames, who is in her 40s and lists her profession as housewife on various bank documents, is the daughter of Lewis R. Snow Holding, former Raleigh First Citizen CEO and chairman who died in 2009. One of two daughters, she has a home on White Oak Road near the Carolina Country Club in Raleigh. Members of the Holding family, which has guided First Citizen of North Carolina for three generations, continue to hold a majority stake in the South Carolina Bank, which they began acquiring in the 1960s. Ames has held seats on the boards of both banks since the 1990s, but did not take a management role, as did her cousins and contemporaries, Frank Holding Jr. and Hope Holding Connell, CEO and Executive Vice President of First Citizens of Raleigh, respectively. Raleigh-based First Citizens and First Citizens of South Carolina operate as separate institutions, linked only by Holding family ownership ties and stylistic similarities in their approach to banking. First Citizens of South Carolina, with total assets of $8.27 billion and 193 branches in South Carolina and Georgia, took itself private back in 2005. Through the first 9 months of 2012, according to FDIC, First Citizens of South Carolina posted a profit of $51 million. Ames, who has a reputation for guarding her privacy, has said only that her December moves were based on a desire to devote more of my energies to family and personal interest. At least one established banking publication, American Banker, while not speculating about Ames' motives, did suggest about the timing of the ownership shift may have been prompted by the prospect of higher income and capital gains taxes due to fears of changes in the law in the wake of any fiscal cliff resolution. Bank expert Don Coker says that speculation may have some merit, especially on the capital gains side of the fiscal cliff equation. The tax ended up rising from 15% to 20% for higher income groups. Even so, Coker adds, there didn't appear to be a race to complete comparable stock shifts elsewhere in the industry. And I think we would have heard about it if it had happened, he says. Continuing on, most hospitals here suffer Medicare cuts due to reform. This article is by Jason DeBruin and comes from Cary. Medicare revenue streams to most Triangle hospitals will be cut due to new rules in which the federal government penalizes those with high readmission rates. One of the stipulations of the Affordable Care Act, often referred to as Obamacare, directed hospitals to reduce the number of patients returning to the hospital within 30 days of a discharge. WakeMed Cary, part of the WakeMed Hospital and Health System, received the highest marks and will not be docked. Duke University Hospital in Durham performed the worst in terms of readmissions and will see its Medicare payments reduced by 0.5%. Medicare is administered through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in Washington, D.C., which also examined how systems implemented a value-based purchasing system. Duke performed well by this metric, so its overall Medicare reduction will only come about 0.25%. Kaiser Health News, affiliated with the Kaiser Family Foundation in Washington, D.C., compiled the penalties announced by the CMS. Medicare spends so much each year on health care in the United States that even a fraction of a percent can represent hundreds of millions of dollars. Consider that the major hospitals in the Triangle received more than $1.6 billion from Medicare last fiscal year alone. Fluctuations of just 0.25% mean $4 million in this area, figure that doesn't include doctor's offices or any community hospitals outside the Triangle's major medical centers. Hospital executives say they're doing what they can to reduce readmissions, and some have even opened clinics to prevent a hospital readmission. Patients are directed to those clinics where they can receive education about how to properly take care of themselves after treatment or receive the proper care without requiring an admission to the hospital. Executives say they would never stop a patient from being admitted in order to dodge the penalty, but they do express frustration for being held accountable for something they can't always control. Certain patients will not do the proper follow-up after hospital treatment and then require a readmission. That's not the hospital's fault, executives say. They are holding the hospitals accountable for what the patient needs to do in home life, says Dr. Christy Henry, WakeMed Medical Director for Case Management. As much as it is a good concept, I think they are approaching it in an unbalanced way. Consider a patient who is admitted for a high blood pressure and is told to cut down on salt intake, but doesn't adhere to the food regimen and must come back within the 30-day limit. Hospitals should not be penalized for such a case, argues Henry. Also, a patient could come back to the hospital for a totally unrelated incident, like a car accident, for example, but that would still count as a readmission under the CMS guidelines. I think CMS could be more balanced in their approach, Henry says. Readmission penalties come with other barriers as well, points out a group led by Mary Naylor, director of the New Cortland Center for Transitions in Health at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing Hospitals can implement strategies to improve rehospitalization rates, but would not necessarily result in improved care for the patients whose admissions were discouraged, the group writes in Health Affairs, a scholarly medical journal. Looking at all admissions to make sure they are needed is something hospital executives say they've been doing for years. Becky Andrews, WakeMed Vice President for Health Information and Utilization Management, says the hospital system hasn't instituted any new policies because of the readmission penalties per se, but that its executives try to think about all hospital admissions as a way to reduce costs. Directing a patient to an appropriate clinic or skilled nursing facility instead of a hospital bed is one way to reduce overall costs, she says. Next up, key days ahead as Eshelman angles for partners for Furix. By Lauren K. Onisores. This article is from Morrisville. January ups the stakes for the Morrisville-based public company Furix Pharmaceuticals. By month ends, its executives will know whether to expect U.S. royalties from longtime partner Takeda Pharmaceuticals. The issue at hand, funding an ongoing Phase 3 trial for a treatment for chronic diarrhea, predominant irritable bowel syndrome, a painful and embarrassing condition that impacts about 28 million patients in the United States and Europe. The treatment, called Mu-Delta, is the first opioid receptor designed to treat the disorder to reach Phase 3. But trials are expensive, and Furix's cash balance of $40 million, reported at the end of the last quarter, is not enough to cover the cost. Furix's last earnings call, Chief Financial Officer Marshall Woodworth said that without a partner for Mu-Delta, research and development spending over the next 15 months was forecast to run between $105 million and $115 million. That's comprised almost entirely of costs related to Mu-Delta. That's where Furix chairman Fred Eshelman hopes royalties and milestones will come in to plug a big gap. Furix's marketed portfolio includes algepiptan, a type of type 2 diabetes treatment that is currently being sold in Japan under the trade name Nicena. Takeda Pharmaceuticals retains the rights to that drug. Over the past 9 months, Furix has received more than $20 million in milestones and more than $11 million in royalties from that partnership and others. But Furix needs more. In that same time period, total research and development expenses were more than $31 million. Furix needs to up its game, and it would should algepiptan be approved for sale in the U.S. The company would then be eligible for a $25 million milestone payment. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration asked Takata to resubmit a new drug application with more information on the drug. Takata did so, including an additional data, this time from Phase 3 clients' clinical trials. Both sets of data include more than 8,000 patients. The FDA will take action this month, and if it finds in Takata's favor, algae Lipton could hit U.S. shelves and Furix coffers. If not, Eshelman says the company simply doesn't know where it will have enough cash to finish the Phase 3 trial, and that it's looking at all of its options. If the royalties do not materialize like they are modeled, or if we do not receive one or more milestones, then there's the possibility that we would have to turn other methods of financing, such as secondary debt monetization, he says. It's a route Furix is familiar with. In August, the company signed a debt agreement with MidCap and Silicon Valley Bank to provide an additional $30 million in term debt, along with a reset of a previous loan for $10 million. But there's another option, a partnership in what Eshelman calls the wild card. With a partnership, the economics of everything are in play, not just Phase 3, but commercialization and so forth, he says. We're always entertaining possibilities of partnerships with all our drugs, he says. A Takata spokesperson says Takata cannot speculate on application outcomes or market implications. Takata is based in Osaka, Japan. Also included in Furix's marketing portfolio is Prilogy, a premature ejaculation drug currently marketed in 15 countries. Its rights are held by Italian firm Menarini, but that drug isn't marketed in the United States, and there is no immediate plans to seek approval for it here. Furix president Dr. June Alamoff told investors in November, "Our primary focus at this time remains on the Mu Delta program." Next up, NCSU's distance education is busting at the seams. From Raleigh. When North Carolina State University fixed a quirk in how it charged for distance education courses, administrators expected an increase in enrollment. And what they got was akin to a bursting dam. "We are busting at the seams for our distance education courses," says Tom Miller, vice provost of the Office of Distance Education and Learning Technology Application, also known as Delta, at North Carolina State University. "In fact, we are filled up. Essentially, the previous policy was unfair to students who took classes full-time on campus, as well as at least one online course. In that subset of students, the numbers speak for themselves. Comparing fall enrollment from 2011 to 2012, subsequent to the change in the policy, students who were enrolled full-time on campus also took at least one online course, increased by 32% to 7,348. At NCSU, tuition for full-time students is capped at 12 credit hours, the standard minimum for full-time classification. That means a student could take 15 or 18 credit hours and pay only for the 12-credit full-time status. Because distance education was calculated separately, however, students who took 12 credits on campus and added 3 or 6 credits online were charged for those online courses in addition to the full-time tuition. This discouraged full-time students from enrolling in online courses, something that NCSU does not want to do. Some courses are offered only once or twice per week, and if that timing doesn't work with a student's schedule, he or she might have to wait until a later semester to graduate. If, however, that student could take their course online, he or she could put the schedule together better and still graduate on schedule. In a memo announcing the tuition change, NCSU Provost Warwick Arden wrote that the university did not anticipate the blended model where students would concurrently take online and face-to-face courses, which, in general, disadvantaged full-time students from favoring part-time students. Of course, this now means that any full-time students on campus are no longer paying the additional tuition for online courses. In the first year alone, this is costing NCSU $2 million in revenue. Because of a complicated formula for how the university receives funding from the state, the loss of revenue is actually even a little more, Miller estimates. Ironically, The change in policy affected how the UNC General Administration classifies its students. In an annual enrollment report, it appears that distance education enrollment at NCSU actually declined by 63%. That's incredibly misleading, says Miller. Excluding NCSU from the UNC report, overall distance education enrollment increased by 5% system-wide. These types of classes are especially convenient for students age 25 and older, who are classified as non-traditional students. That group makes up two-thirds of all students taking distance education courses, according to the UNC system. These online courses are those that offer full credit and lead to a degree just like any course inside a classroom. Class sizes are capped and students perform graded work just as those on campus do. That's different than the hot new trend in higher education that goes by the fashionable acronym MOOC, M-O-O-C, Massive Open Online Course. These are typically free and open to anyone with an internet connection. They are essentially lectures from college professors on various topics, but do not offer any college credit. Duke University has been an early adopter of these courses. Mohammed Noor, a professor of genetics and evolution, taught a MOOC and came away with a positive experience. There's a great thirst for knowledge by the broader community outside the ivory tower, says Noor. Those of us in academia take for granted what we see every day. But most of the world doesn't have this access, and they are busy making their own livelihoods such that they can't commit to the costs and time associated with hanging out at colleges and universities. And now an article about technology from Lauren K. Onisorge. Game makers work to adapt as apps rule. This article is from Carrie. The profile of video game customers is changing. It's a reality that was evident to video game companies this past holiday season. Lines for new consoles used to wrap around the block. Yet a week before Christmas, a stack of new Nintendo devices framed the electronics sections unsold. Video game analyst and Seattle-based tech-savvy global CEO Scott Steinberg says the stakes and costs are rising in the industry, and a goodly number of Triangle companies are working to adapt. Many publishers are facing increasing pressure from smartphone and tablet apps, he explains. As opposed to paying $60 for a premium product, they're logging on to the Apple Store with their iPads, he says. Are local companies ready to step up to the mobile challenge? Mobile gaming. It's an industry-wide shift and one that could be responsible for executive changes at Cary-based Epic Games, a company that employs 160 in the Triangle. In the last couple of months, the company lost two of its leading minds, design director Cliff Bleszinski and president Mike Capps, with little explanation from the company as to their departures. Let's put it this way, Steinberg says. Were I an executive in their position, now is a pretty good time to be exploring any exit strategy if I want to secure my legacy. Epic executives are not talking, but company spokesperson Dana Cowley did point out, along with its signature Gears of War program, Epic has been pushing its Infinity Blade apps, which has been featured in Apple's iPhone 4 and iPad television campaigns. The Infinity Blade franchise topped $30 million in revenue in January. Additionally, the company's Unreal Engine has been licensed to titles that include Warner Brothers' Batman Arkham City Lockdown. Naturally, mobile is a huge growth area, Cowley says. But it's not always a hugely profitable one, Steinberg points out. Think 99 cents for a download versus $50 or $60 for a console title. A game has to go viral to be profitable or have an additional monetizing strategy, such as embedded advertising. Epic might have an advantage over other companies in licensing its Unreal Engine to developers, says Steinberg. Epic has been licensing its technology to developers in several different areas, including for the creation of military simulations, and that diversification could prove valuable. Red Storm Entertainment, Tom Clancy's former outfit that was purchased by French developer Ubisoft in 2000, has 147 local employees. Its vice president of product development, Elizabeth Loverso, is based in Raleigh and says Red Storm is all too aware of the changing industry. We started with some games that were focused on the PC and multiplayer, she says, adding that the Red Storm advantage could be in the social aspect of gaming, online multiplayer games such as Ghost Recon. Gaming is so very social, she says, adding that Red Storm is developing new ways for gamers to interact, and mobile is part of the strategy. Ubisoft makes numerous games that you're able to play connected on iPad. Some of our titles have those components to them, such as, and we've got Ghost Recon Online. The consumer, she says, isn't changing their likes and dislikes with games. What's changing is the way consumers access the games. We see the consumer as wanting to play anywhere, anytime, Loverso says. We try to connect our players so they have the opportunity to play our games on different platforms. But Red Storm won't be abandoning consoles. We're expecting the gamers, true gamers, will continue to use consoles, she says. We see an opportunity in all of these platforms going forward. I think we're pretty well spread out. Loverso, like Steinberg, says the entire industry has to change its focus. You have to be where the consumer is, she says. The consumer is going to be connected and not just mobile. We've got the internet coming into the living room. Gaming is a very social aspect of people's lives, and I believe they will be playing in browsers, and they will be playing in their living rooms as well as with their friends on iPads and tablets. But there are other factors to consider. Developers, even the big ones, have to be prepared for new legal challenges, says Wyrick Robbins attorneys Zach Bishop and Chris Sorey. Take copywriting in the mobile space. Because mobile games are obviously sold through an app marketplace or game marketplace, there are going to be more and more knockoff versions of the game that people develop to confuse purchasers, Bishop says. To test that, search for a popular game on your iPhone and see how many similar titles come up in the search selection. Game companies are going to find themselves having to police these potential infringers, Sorey cautions. They'll also have to battle counterfeit apps, Bishop says. I think you'll see more companies giving out games for free than making their revenue through microtransactions like in-game purchases, Bishop says. He also anticipates seeing a requirement that a user be online connected through Wi-Fi or data network to operate the game. Bishop says the new challenges include the price of operating in a mobile environment, and gamers will have to adapt. The mobile world is here, after all, and not going anywhere, and it's bringing in more developers. The price of entry as far as developing a mobile game is significantly less than developing a game for console, he says. You'll see a lot of 1-, 2-, 3-person companies developing games and putting them in the App Store, whereas if you're putting in a full-blown console game, it takes a whole team of people. And for the first time, those small players will have an avenue to someday be real competitors alongside household name gaming companies. A notable example, Rovio, which delivered the Angry Birds franchise to the mobile world. And now a spotlight on banking and finance. McCrory team to name finance chiefs, by Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. The McCrory administration has yet to tip its hand on two key regulatory appointments affecting North Carolina chartered banks and credit unions. Banking Commissioner Ray Grace has been serving in an acting capacity for 11 months, since Joe Smith departed to oversee the National Mortgage Settlement. It's a position nominated by the governor and approved by the General Assembly. In a bill which then-Governor Perdue nominated Grace to the job on a permanent basis was left in the hopper when the legislature adjourned last year. Ask the new administration's plan, spokesman Chris Walker says a review of all state boards and agencies over which the governor has appointment power currently is underway. Not just that particular one, banking commissioner. We're looking at all of them and ways to come up with a good list of candidates, he says. Grace, who's been with the commission since the late 1960s, oversees the financial stability of more than 90 North Carolina chartered banks and holds the licensing power over the consumer finance and mortgage industries in the state. He has widespread support among the state's community bankers. The second open slot is administrator of the North Carolina Credit Union Division, the office that oversees the soundness of 49 state-chartered credit unions, including the Raleigh-based State Employees Credit Union, the nation's second largest. Jerry K.J., who held the post for 17 years, stepped down at year's end. Assistant Administrator Rose Connor is running the office on a temporary basis until a new administrator is appointed, and Commerce Department spokesman John Ellis is in comment on that. It will be up to Sharon Decker, the state's new Commerce Secretary, to make the appointment. Whoever gets the assignment high up on the new administrator's to-do list will be finding a way to smooth over a dispute between state regulators and their counterparts at the National Credit Union Administration, also known as NCUA. The split began when Jay approved a temporary program under which State Employees Credit Union, in an act of transparency, released its normally super-secret CAMEL finance strength rating. Federal regulators vehemently opposed to the move, and they responded by no longer accepting the auditing work of the North Carolina Credit Union Division, ordering their own auditors into the field to examine the books of the North Carolina unions, which ended up bearing the time and the cost of two financial examinations. Credit union leaders from across the state want the controversy ended. And we will be following the selection of a new administrator with a lot of interest, says Jeff Harden of the Raleigh-based North Carolina Credit Union League. This week's guest column on the editorial page is from Mr. Andy Ellen. Mr. Ellen is president and general counsel for the North Carolina Retail Merchants Association. This article is entitled Separating Fact from Fiction on Jobless Insurance. The federal government isn't the only one facing a fiscal cliff. North Carolina is staring down its own fiscal cliff in the form of a $2.5 billion debt in loans from the federal government to help the state fund its unemployment insurance system. North Carolina has the fourth highest unemployment insurance debt in the nation. That is not a top 10 list on which we want to be. We didn't get into this situation overnight. As unemployment skyrocketed in the state during the recession, unemployment claims climbed above the trust fund's balance. North Carolina, like many other states in similar situations, made the decision to borrow money from the federal government to continue to make payments to the unemployed. Now, just like anyone else who uses credit rather than cash to fund large expenses, North Carolina's debt has come due. The interest payment alone in 2012 was $77 million. Who paid this interest? North Carolina employers. The same employers who are working to expand their businesses as we climb out of the recession and add jobs. The retail industry added over 465,000 employees nationally to their payrolls for the holiday shopping season. But the instability in the unemployment insurance fund threatens to stall hiring and threaten economic growth on the state level. Going into a new legislative session, lawmakers knew they had a choice to either demonstrate leadership by making the hard decision to fix the problem once and for all, or watch as the federal government taxes North Carolina businesses an additional $21 per employee incrementally every year until 2019. The General Assembly has chosen the leadership path. On January 8, 2013, the Revenue Laws Study Committee approved a comprehensive proposal to the North Carolina General Assembly that would pay off the $2.5 billion debt by 2015, rebuild a $1 billion surplus in the unemployment insurance fund to prepare for the next economic downturn, and restore North Carolina's employment security system to its intended function of being a re-employment agency rather than a benefit agency. Numerous news articles have criticized the revenues laws proposal, lamenting the proposed reduction in benefits for the unemployed. At the same time, the proposal has been made out to be a sweetheart deal for North Carolina business community. Here are some separations. Fiction. North Carolina got into this debt because employers were not paying enough unemployment taxes. Fact. This billion-dollar program is neither the sole result of significant unemployment insurance benefits expansion nor caused solely by a reduction in unemployment insurance taxes paid by North Carolina employers in the 1990s. It was a combination of these two factors. A real solution must address both of these factors. Fiction. North Carolina businesses are getting a sweetheart deal. Fact. North Carolina employers pay 100% of unemployment insurance taxes. Employees pay nothing. All of North Carolina's employers saw their unemployment insurance tax bill rise by $21 per employee in 2012 and will undergo another $21 per employee increase in 2013. Critics downplay the current plan to repay the federal debt as just loose change for employers. For a local independent grocery store with 50 employees, that loose change amounts to $2,100 in additional unemployment tax this year, then $3,150 in 2014, and $4,200 in 2015, and so on. Without reform by 2019, the additional cost per employee will increase 330% from an additional $21 to an additional $189, or $9,450 for the independent grocer with 50 employees. Fiction. The General Assembly is imposing new taxes on business. Fact. The proposal approved by the Revenue Laws Study Committee ensures the unemployment system is solvent by 2015 by overhauling the current system with renewed focus on returning unemployed workers to jobs. Unemployment insurance taxes will increase until 2015, but at the same time, the amount as the federal tax increases. The difference is that the debt would be paid off in 2015 rather than 2019. Fiction. North Carolina's unemployment benefits would be some of the worst in the country. Fact. North Carolina currently allows for 26 weeks of unemployment, while the southeastern average is 23 weeks. North Carolina's maximum weekly wage amount is $506, while the southeastern average is $348. North Carolina's current wage base is $20,400, while the southeastern average is $10,816. The Revenue Laws Study Committee proposal simply brings North Carolina in line with these national averages. Fiction. North Carolina's unemployment insurance debt is having no effect on reducing the unemployment rate. Fact. The state's current unemployment rate of 9.1% ranks as the fifth worst in the United States. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.